It is indeed my pleasure to be able to be with you today. It was a great honor to be requested to be here with you all. And I hope that what we have to say and what we have to do this week will be of some benefit to you. I hope that when everything is said and done, you can say that it was a meaningful experience for you to have been here. Open up in your Bibles, in your Old Testaments, if you would, to the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 12, that is where we will begin. The first two verses of the 137th Psalm read, "By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hung our harps upon the willows in the midst of it." As you are probably all too aware by now, the subject for this week's VBS is going to be the book of Daniel. And I thought what we might try to do this morning, and I know it's very ambitious, but we're going to give it a shot anyways, we're going to try to put the book of Daniel in a historical context as it relates to the Old Testament. And so we're going to try to go back and put the Babylonian captivity, the Medo-Persian captivity, and things like that back into the context of Scripture so we can see where we're following along some sort of biblical timeline here. Some people really like Old Testament studies. Some people really don't like Old Testament studies. We'll get through this and we'll try to make it as poignant as applicable as possible. If you're there, Genesis chapter 12. You know the story very well, I'm sure. Adam and Eve. We move forward from that with their children. We move forward from that. We come to Noah. And then we're here in Genesis chapter 12 and we're introduced to this individual at the time named Abram. And in Genesis chapter 12, as you know very well, I'm sure, there are multiple promises that are made by God to Abraham. In the course of chapter 12, beginning in verse 1, the Lord had said to Abram, "Get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse him who curses you, and in you all of the families of the earth shall be blessed." The promise of a great nation that would come from Abram. There's the promise that through his seed all of the nations of the earth would be blessed. And then as you go a little bit further down, but maybe we can see it a little bit better in chapter 17, there is the promise that for this land or for this nation that God would give Abraham from his seed, to them would be given land. Chapter 17 and verse 7. "I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you and their generations for an everlasting covenant to be a God to you and to your descendants after you. Also, verse 8, I give to you and your descendants after you the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan, as an everlasting possession, and I will be their God." Each and every one of these promises that God made to Abraham, these were all eventually fulfilled. The great nation would be the nation of Israel. You read that in the first chapter of the book of Deuteronomy. We won't turn over there right now, but you can certainly note that and read that if you want on your own time. That is the great nation that would come from Abraham. The promised seed is Jesus Christ. Paul makes this argument in the third chapter of the book of Galatians, that the seed who came from Abraham in whom all the nations of the earth would be blessed was Jesus Christ himself. But I would have you turn over to this passage, if you would, with me. 1 Kings chapter 4. 1 Kings chapter 4, because here we see the writer of the book of Kings making the application or proving the point that the land promise that had been made by God to Abraham was fully received. In 1 Kings chapter 4, and in the 20th verse, the text says, "Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand by the sea in multitude, eating and drinking and rejoicing. And so Solomon reigned over all the kingdom from the river to the land of the Philistines as far as the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life." If you hold your finger there or just turn back to Genesis chapter 17 one more time very quickly, you find out that the land over which Solomon is ruling here is the very description of the kind of land that had been given to the people. Genesis 17, we saw the promise there and what was going to be given. That land was going to be given to them. 1 Kings chapter 4 and verse 21, it was fulfilled. A practical application we might take from that is this. We hear a lot of people in the religious world today talking about how there are still promises yet to be received by the physical nation of Israel. That they are still awaiting the fulfillment of the reception of these land promises. That there's still some lacking promise that God made to Abraham that they have not yet received. But 1 Kings chapter 4 and verse 21 makes it very clearly that the land that was promised was the land that was inherited, the land that was received. That promise has been fully received. There's no promise that God made to Abraham that is yet awaiting fulfillment. Those promises were made and those promises were fulfilled by God. You move forward from Abraham. And as you move through the book of Genesis, of course, we've got Abraham, we've got Isaac, we've got Jacob, and we've got Joseph, and that's where the story of Genesis ends, with Joseph. We've got Joseph being sold off into slavery by his brothers, but as he arrives then in Egypt, he begins to rise in power from Potiphar's house, all the way up to second in the kingdom. In the 41st chapter, you remember, Joseph's brothers have to come before him because they're seeking bread because of the famine that is in all the land. They don't recognize Joseph. Joseph recognizes his brothers, though, and eventually he brings his family with him there to live in Egypt. They're going to live in Egypt. Their people are going to stay there in Egypt. And like you see in a lot of places, like you see many times throughout history, regime change brings trouble. And as you look at the book of Exodus in chapter 1, you find out that the change in regime there in Egypt brought some problems for the descendants of Joseph. The first chapter of the book of Exodus. And you read in verse 7 that the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. But there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. You remember Joseph had been brought into the good graces of the king. He was very highly respected. But now here comes a new king. Here comes a new Pharaoh on the scene. One who does not know Joseph. One who doesn't have the same amount of respect for him. In verse 9 he said to his people, "Look, the children of Israel are more and they are mightier than we. Come and let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply and it happen in the event of war, that they also join our enemies and fight against us and so go up out of the land." And so verse 11, that's when the Egyptians begin to make the lives of the Israelites very hard. You remember they're making the bricks and they're taking away the straw and things like that. They're just making their lives very, very difficult. The Hebrew population here is forced into slavery. But as they're put into slavery, this gives opportunity for a leader to arise. And one indeed does arise, although at the beginning very reluctantly, in Moses. And that's in the second chapter of Exodus, all throughout the 14th chapter. Moses rises to the scene here. Very reluctantly at first, he kind of doubts God. When God calls him to this, he offers up excuse after excuse. Some admittedly offered out of humility, but still excuses nonetheless. So God finally convinces him, "You're going to be the one who's going to lead the people." And Moses begins from that point forward to take his role, to cement his place in the history of Israel. Turn over to the book of Numbers, chapter 14. The book of Exodus is all about them leaving. They leave Egypt, you remember, following the 10 plagues, cross over the Red Sea. And then immediately we begin to see something that's going to occur over and over and over again in the life of the Israelite nation. And that was murmuring. They start to complain. "Have you brought us out of Egypt to die here in the wilderness?" Never mind the fact, what had they just seen? They had just seen God part the Red Sea, bring them through on dry ground, and bring down the sea over the pursuing Egyptians. And the first thing we can say now, a few days later, is, "Have you brought us out here to die in the wilderness?" What a lack of faith. But sadly, that's going to be something that we see throughout the existence of this nation, is their failure to fully rely upon God, a lack in their faith. Numbers chapter 14 tells us some information about one of those episodes where their faith was lacking. They are supposed to go in, they're supposed to take the promised land. They're supposed to take the land of Canaan. God tells them to go up, spy out the land. They spy out the land for 40 days. They return back. You remember the story. All the spies say, "We can't do it except for whom? You remember? You can shout it out. It's okay. All right. We've got Joshua and we've got Caleb, right? We've got two good reports. And so what God says in Numbers chapter 14, in verse 34, according to the number of the days in which you spied out the land, 40 days for each day you shall bear your guilt, 1 year, namely 40 years, and you shall know my rejection. 40 days they had spent spying out the land, so God says, 40 years you will wander in the wilderness. That generation would die off, save Joshua and Caleb, the ones who were going to then be able to enter the promised land. Moses himself does not get to enter the promised land. You remember he's able to ascend up on the mountain to look over the promised land, and then his life is taken from him. But eventually we get to the land of Canaan. And this is the book of Joshua. Turn over there with me. Joshua chapter 1. Moses dies. And as you go back and you read those first five books of the Old Testament, you see a character being introduced, and that is Joshua. He appears time after time, kind of at the right hand of Moses. He was somebody that Moses had been grooming, kind of Moses' right-hand man. And in Joshua chapter 1, we find out that at the death of Moses, Joshua is going to be the one who is going to take leadership of the nation, as it were, and begin to pilot them into the land of Canaan. After the death of Moses, Joshua 1 and 1, the servant of the Lord, it came to pass that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan, you and all the people, to the land which I am giving to them. Joshua 1, the land that I am giving to them, 1 Kings chapter 4 and verse 1, the land was received. Verse 3, every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon I have given you, as I said to Moses, from the wilderness and to this Lebanon, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites to the great sea toward the going down of the sun shall be your territory. You saw those rivers mentioned, 1 Kings chapter 4. The land that God had promised to Abraham is the land promise that was now being renewed to Joshua, and it was the land promise that they would eventually receive in 1 Kings chapter 4. Now, as you go to the end of the book of Joshua, and as Joshua begins to give his farewell address both to the elders of the people and to the people themselves, in chapter 23, Joshua warns the people just exactly what God had been warning them before. That is, as you go in to this land, what you are to do is you are to drive out all the nations that are in front of you. You're not to leave them. You're not to form alliances with them. You are to destroy them. Get them out of the land. In Joshua 23 and verse 9, we read, the Lord has driven out from before you great and strong nations, but as for you, no one has been able to stand against you this day. One man of you shall chase a thousand, for the Lord your God is he who fights for you, as he promised you. Therefore, take careful heed to yourselves that you love the Lord your God, or else, verse 12, if indeed you do go back and cling to the remnant of these nations, these that remain among you, and make marriages with them, and go into them, and they to you, know for certain that the Lord your God will no longer drive out these nations from before you. But they shall be snares and traps to you, and scourges on your sides, and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from this good land which the Lord your God has given you. Go out, drive out the nations, serve God, serve Him with your whole heart, and all will be well. But if you fail to do what God says, Joshua warns, if you fail to serve Him, if you fail to do what He calls you to do, there will be trouble, there will be ramifications. There'll be snares to you. There'll be thorns in your eyes. They will be troublesome. And indeed, as we go through, we find out that's just exactly what occurred. Here's a point we might notice as well. The reception of the land of Canaan. Go back to Genesis chapter 15 very quickly. The reception of the land of Canaan, the reception of this land promise that God made Abraham, was unconditional. The reception of the land promise was unconditional. The 15th chapter of the book of Genesis. This is kind of one of the more different chapters in the book of Genesis. Abraham trying to stay awake, and we've got the animals that are split in two except for the birds that are facing one another. and you've got the smoking torch, the burning oven passing through the middle of the animals, and it's something that doesn't really translate over into our culture very well. But when you go back and you understand what's going on in Genesis 15, the symbolism behind all of that is when one would make a covenant, make a promise, and would pass through the animals like this, the one who was passing through the animals, it was as if that person were saying, may this occur to me if I do not fulfill what I have promised. And as you look at the 15th chapter of the book of Genesis, who is it that is seen to be passing through the midst of the animals? Well, in the form of this smoking torch, burning oven, or other way around, it's whom? It's representative of God. And what is he saying here to Abraham? This is the promise that I have made you, and this is the promise I myself will fulfill it. He is showing Abraham the surety of what he has promised. Israel's reception of Canaan was an unconditional promise that was made to Abraham. But let's settle this point in our minds, that their retention of the land was not unconditional. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 28 with me. Deuteronomy chapter 28. While the initial possession of the land was unconditional, if the people, if the nation of Israel was going to retain the land, there were certain conditions attached to that. As Joshua alluded to there in chapter 23, Israel's military might did not stem from the fact that they were a populous nation. It didn't stem from the fact that they were great military minds. Israel was successful in battle and in conquest for one reason. God was with her. And that was the only reason she was successful. As you look at the 28th chapter of the book of Deuteronomy here, look first with me at verse 1. It shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all His commandments which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth. Look down to verse 7. The Lord will cause your enemies who rise against you to be defeated before your face. They shall come out against you one way and flee before you seven ways. The promise is, if you're faithful to God, God will continue His protection over you. But look over to verse 14. You shall not turn aside from any of the words which I command you this day to the right or to the left to go after other gods to serve them. But it shall come to pass, if you do not obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all His commandments and His statutes which I command you today, that all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. And beginning there at verse 16, he begins to list all the bad things that would happen if they turned away from God. Look at verse 20. The Lord your God will send on you cursing, confusion, and rebuke in all that you set your hand to do, until you are destroyed and until you perish quickly because of the wickedness of your doings in which you have forsaken me. Verse 25. The Lord will cause you to be defeated before your enemies. You shall go out one way against them and flee seven ways before them, and you shall become troublesome to all the kingdoms of the earth. Verses 36 and 37. The Lord will bring you and the king whom you set over you to a nation which neither you nor your fathers have known, and there you shall serve other gods, wood and stone, and you shall become an astonishment, a proverb, and a byword among all the nations where the Lord will drive you out. You serve God, you'll remain in the land, but if you turn away from God, what will happen? You'll be dispossessed, you'll be driven out. The Lord will bring another nation upon you whom you don't know, and they will drive you out. Understand this, Israel remaining in the land was not an unconditional promise. Their staying in the land and thriving in the land was wholly dependent upon their faithfulness to God. Well, Joshua dies. It brings us to the period of the judges. For a period of somewhere around 380 years, Israel is going to be ruled by a series of warrior judges. You remember Judges chapter 2, the children of Israel served God all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua, but then there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord their God. And that would set in the cycle that you see there in chapter 2, verses 15 and 17. Israel would fall into sin. they would be taken captive. They would cry out for a deliverer. God would raise up a judge. The judge would deliver them for a period of years, usually somewhere around 40 years. But then the same thing would happen again. The people would become complacent. They would fall back into sin, and the same cycle would repeat itself. That's really what's going on all throughout the book of Judges. You come to the end of the period of the judges in 1 Samuel. And in 1 Samuel chapter 8, you see the people clamoring for this time period to end. They're looking for some better type of leadership, because they look in 1 Samuel 8 at Samuel's sons who are to rule after he is gone, and they say they're just wicked. Which apparently they were. And so they cry out and they say, we don't want Samuel's sons to rule over us, but rather than making a wise decision, they do the very thing that God had warned against multiple times already throughout Scripture, and that was a king. They cry out for a king. A king so that they might be like all the other nations around them, a king who could go out and to lead them into battle. How quickly they had forgotten the leadership of God. A king is given them. 1 Samuel chapter 9, you find out that the king that is going to be set over them is one by the name of Saul. And so Saul is going to rule over the nation. And here's, some people love dates, some people hate dates. Okay, I like dates. They kind of help me get everything into a historical context. If you don't like the dates, don't worry about the dates. Okay, just pretend it's not there. But around 1050 B.C., and of course none of these dates are firm, they're the best approximation we can get. But around 1050 B.C. is when Saul is going to rise to the throne. Acts 13, 1 Kings 2, 2 Chronicles 9 all reveal to us that Saul, David, Solomon, each of them reigned for about 40 years. So you've got a period of 120 years beginning around 1050 B.C., which we would call the period of the United Kingdom. When Israel is one. Really, the nation probably reaches its pinnacle, judging by how you define reaching its pinnacle, probably reached that pinnacle under the rule of Solomon. 2 Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 7, the house of God which David had been forbidden to build, Solomon is able to build that. Remember, the glory of God comes in the form of a cloud and fills the whole house which Solomon had constructed there in 2 Chronicles 6 and 7. Look at 2 Chronicles chapter 1. You find the nation under the reign of Solomon being very physically prosperous. 2 Chronicles chapter 1. I know I have verse 15 on here, but go back to verse 13. I want us to start in 2 Chronicles 1 and verse 13. Solomon came to Jerusalem from the high place that was at Gibeon, from before the tabernacle of meeting, and reigned over Israel. And Solomon gathered chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots, 12,000 horsemen, whom he stationed in the chariot cities with the king in Jerusalem. The king also made silver and gold as common in Jerusalem as stones. He made the cedars as abundant as the sycamores, which are in the lowland. During Solomon's rule in Israel, silver and gold were like gravel, we would say. You're talking about a nation that is overwhelmingly prosperous. And coupled with what you see back in verse 14, apparently they were very militarily settled. They've got all these chariots, all of these horsemen. And from the outside looking in, they look like a well-fortified nation. Let me ask you a question. Go back to Deuteronomy chapter 17. Do you remember any of the warnings that God gave concerning kings? God gave some warnings back in Deuteronomy 17 about some things that the kings were not to multiply. They were not to hoard up. Anyone remember what some of those were? Horses. Don't multiply horses. Anyone else brave enough to take a shot? I know it's the kind of nebulous stuff back in Deuteronomy, the stuff that we all kind of might pass over real quickly when we're reading. Don't multiply horses. Let's read it. Deuteronomy chapter 17. Verse 14, when you come into the land which the Lord your God is giving you and possess it and dwell in it and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses, one from among your brethren. You shall set as a king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. But he shall not, verse 16, he shall not multiply horses, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For the Lord has said, you shall not return that way again. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. Don't multiply horses, don't multiply wives, don't multiply silver, don't multiply gold. Why not multiply horses? Military, right? Multiplying the horses would cause that king to think what? The power lies in me and not in God. Why warn against multiplying the wives? Two reasons, one of which is listed there in the text. Why? Turn his heart away. And who's the greatest example of that we see? Solomon, right? In his old age, the many wives turned his heart away from God. But how about this, in your studies of the Old Testament, when were wives exchanged? Anyone remember that? The exchange of wives was sometimes something that was done under the giving of a daughter to another man as a wife, was sometimes done as a way to seal a covenant, an alliance. And what had God warned about years ago? That Israel was not to engage in making any what? Any alliances with the other nations. You see, a couple of different reasons they weren't to multiply wives. And don't multiply silver, don't multiply gold. That love of money. One gets all of that money, all of that power, and they begin to think what? What did Nebuchadnezzar say? Look at this great Babylon, you know, and who built it all, Nebuchadnezzar says? Me. We can see that trap that the kings could fall into very quickly. Following Solomon, following his reign, around 930 B.C., and again, these dates are soft, but around 930 B.C., it's when the kingdom is going to divide. You've got King Solomon who rules for 40 years, from around 970 to 930 B.C. Following his reign, the kingdom is going to divide into north and south. The north 10 tribes, we call them normally Israel. Sometimes you'll see them referred to in Scripture as Ephraim. The southern kingdom, Judah, made of the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. Generally, we see them referred to Judah. Sometimes in the prophets, you'll also see them referred to as Israel, which can make things kind of confusing, but you just got to stick with your context there. The period of the two nations. Which one lasts longer, Israel or Judah? Judah's going to last longer, that's right. Judah actually has some good kings. They actually have some good leadership. Versus Israel, which never has a good leader for the entire duration, of the nation. Just a few facts, a few things to note here. Like we said, there are no good kings for the northern kingdom. Who is the first king of the northern kingdom? Solomon dies. Who's going to rule over the northern kingdom? Jeroboam, right? It's just the opposite way from, you would think Jeroboam and Judah, but that's not it. It's Rehoboam and Judah. It's Jeroboam and Israel. Jeroboam, Ahab. Ahab's one of the kings in the northern kingdom. We all know him. We know his story. Hoshea, going to wrap things up there in the northern kingdom. Not a lot of prophets to the northern kingdom. You've got Amos, who prophesies most probably to the northern kingdom, and Hosea. I tend to think Hosea went to the northern kingdom. If Harold or Reagan has taught something different here, then just we'll defer to them. But I tend to think Hosea went to the northern kingdom, but you'll find different areas of agreement or disagreement on that. The southern kingdom, Judah, you had some good kings. You had some good leadership here. Not all of them were good by any stretch of the imagination, but you had some who were good. Rehoboam begins the king, begins the reign of the kings here. You've got Uzziah, who was one of the kings. You remember him, goes into the temple, offers sacrifice, offers the incense, which he's not supposed to, is struck with leprosy. Leper until he dies, a great lesson there on God's authority. Hezekiah was one of the kings down here of Judah. We know about him. We read about him in Isaiah as well. And then Manasseh. Manasseh, who for much of his reign is a very wicked and an ungodly man. Look at 2 Kings chapter 24. Manasseh serves as a good point of reference here in Judah, because really from Manasseh onwards, you're looking at just a downhill slide. Second Kings chapter 24 and verse 3, as you skip ahead in the story a little bit, you're reading about when Judah is going to be overrun by Babylon here, but in verse 3, we're given some reasons as to why Judah is going to be overrun. And in verse 3, we read, "Surely at the commandment of the Lord this came upon Judah, to remove them from his sight because of the sins of Manasseh, according to all that he had done." Now, Manasseh, apparently at his older age, does have a change of heart. But we mostly know him for the notorious reign that he had, for all of the sin and all of the injustice that built up in the kingdom under his reign. And as you read 2 Kings 24 and 3, it was because of the sins of Manasseh, and because those sins of Manasseh persisted in the nation, that Judah was going to be overrun by the Babylonians. Isaiah, Daniel, and Jeremiah, prophets who served the southern kingdom of Judah here. Now, northern kingdom around 722 B.C. is going to fall to Assyria. Around 612 B.C., Assyria is going to fall to Babylon. So very quickly, 722 B.C., Israel falls. Judah is going to last until ultimately 586 B.C., and in 586 B.C., Judah will also fall to Babylon. Babylon has overrun Assyria, which had overrun Israel, and now Babylon overruns Judah. Babylon is this preeminent world power at the time, and Daniel chapter 2 would confirm that when Daniel says to Nebuchadnezzar, "You, O king, you are the head of gold. But then there will arise another kingdom inferior to you." And here's what I want you to grasp is when we're there in 586 B.C. and the period after that, that's where Daniel comes in. Israel has been taken into Babylonian captivity. Daniel apparently goes off with the first bunch, 606 B.C. We'll talk more about that later. And that is how we get Daniel over in Babylon. He is taken captive by Nebuchadnezzar and put into the king's house around 606, 605 B.C. Babylon is eventually judged by God. Jeremiah chapter 50 talks about this. They were taken captive. Israel was because they had sinned. Babylon is in power. Babylon is going to be judged because of their sin, Jeremiah tells us. And so they are judged by the Medo-Persian Empire. The Medes and the Persians come in here, just as Daniel had prophesied. They come in, and in 536 B.C., after the Medes and the Persians overrun, this is around 539, 538, when the Medes and the Persians overrun Babylon. Finally, in 536, Cyrus issues a decree for all of the Jews to go home. That's the very last of what you read in 2 Chronicles chapter 36. It's the beginning of the book of Ezra. "All whose heart in them is turned towards the Lord your God, go back, rebuild the city, rebuild the walls, rebuild the temple." You will note 586 B.C. to 516 B.C. is 70 years. From 606 B.C., the first time Nebuchadnezzar came in, until 536 B.C., when Cyrus issues the decree to go home, is 70 years. 70 years have been prophesied that Israel would be judged, that Judah would be judged for her sin, but then after 70 years, she would be able to go home. It's very interesting, and it's a great lesson how divine prophecy fits in with history today. Daniel prophesied Medo-Persia would fall to Greece. Daniel chapter 8, both of these empires are mentioned by name, the Medes and the Persians, and also Greece. The goat would come with one horn, and I heard the first bell already, didn't I? This is my favorite part here. I love this part. The goat that's coming in that represents Greece, we're told, with this one prominent horn. The Grecian kingdom, spearheaded by whom? Alexander the Great, right? Alexander the Great comes in, and as he comes in, he butts heads with the Medo-Persian Empire. Medo-Persia falls to the Grecian Empire. Alexander doesn't get to rule over it a whole long time because he dies relatively young. And as Daniel 8 tells us, that big horn is split into how many horns? Remember? Four of them, right? When Alexander died, his kingdom was divided amongst 4, right? Upon Alexander's death, the Grecian Empire divided between Cassander, who got Macedonia, Ptolemy, who got Egypt, Lysimachus, who got Thrace and Asia Minor, and Seleucus, who got Syria. There are great lessons all throughout here how biblical prophecy matches up with history as we know it today. It's a great testament to the reliability of Scripture. You know, these are the things we never see the antagonists of Old Testament literature talk about. We'll hear people talk about the moral code under the old law. Usually they misunderstand that. We'll hear people talk about, you know, nations that supposedly didn't exist but in recent years have been proven to exist. But we never hear about how it all meshes up, do we? We never hear how it all fits together. But it does. And so you see this great picture here. The very things Daniel prophesies about. This bit here with Medo-Persia falling to Greece. Medo-Persia is going to fall to Greece around ultimately 330 B.C. Was Daniel writing in the 500s? He's writing about events some 200 years off in the future. And yet nailing them with pinpoint accuracy. Anyway, we covered it. We got through about 1,800 years, which is what I wanted us to do. But we see where Daniel is here in Babylon. We've got him there, and that's where we'll pick up, Lord willing, Monday morning. Thank you for your good attention this morning. I appreciate it.